Hi, and welcome to the Japan Baseball Weekly Podcast for December 29th. It's brought to you by One World Sports. I'm John Gibson, and with me in cyberspace for the final time in 2014 is Jim Allen. How's it going, bud?
Don't take me. I liked 2014. Yeah.
Ready to see this year go.
Things are going very well here, but cyberspace is... You know, it's almost like as if in cyberspace, no one can hear you talk.
Yeah. Well, it's a cluttered cyberspace. Something's going on. Anyway, the computer gods and the technological gods are out to get me this morning. So I don't know how the show sounds. It probably doesn't sound very good. And we apologize for the technical difficulties. But on this week's show, we've got an interview with Andrew Marchand of ESPN. And we're going to discuss free agents. So let's get started.
Rearing the bases.
All right. Our trivia question this week comes from Dave in Baltimore. He's a friend of the show. And he has sent, this is, I think, is his third trivia question for us.
Wow.
So, yeah,
he's done
awesome.
He's done more than I have.
Almost as much, let's put it that way. But it just shows how much the others are slacking. So get with the program, guys, if you would, please. All right, so he says, what team has won the Nippon Series or Japan Series the most times with different ownership groups?
Well, that wouldn't be the Yomiuri Giants.
They've just won it the most times.
That wouldn't be the Yomiuri Giants because, as we know, yesterday's newspaper had, today is the 80th anniversary of Japanese professional baseball, which is fine, except it's not true. Japanese professional baseball started like 8 years before the Giants decided to take part in that endeavor. They restarted Japanese baseball 80 years ago. Professional baseball.
Well, you know, they were just warming up.
Yeah,
the party didn't really start until the Giants arrived, right?
That's right. When the Shibaura Club became Japan's first professional team in the 20s. They were just saying, keeping the seat warm for the Yomiuri, which at that time was, you know, not really the Yomiuri.
Okay. All right, you've wasted enough time. Answer the question.
The most Japan series under different ownership groups. Now, you know the answer to this, correct?
Right, because he sent it a while back, and I kind of...
Okay.
And then he sent me the answer, and then I scrolled down, so...
The Taiyo Whales have three, because... They merged with the Shochiku Robins, and then they won one as the Taiyo Whales, and they won one as the Yokohama Bay Stars. The Seibu Lions, no, because they only won with the Nishitetsu Lions. I would say, Nankai Hawks, Swallows have only won two, Chunichi have never changed. Wow.
That's interesting, because
Lotte is a possibility too.
Well, I'm going to stop you. I'm going to stop your train of thought, because the three, the Bay Stars, I only had the Bay Stars as far as I knew. I just knew Taiyo Whales. They had another ownership group.
The Taiyo Whales won, and the that's right. They were still Taiyo when they were the Yokohama Bay Stars. They just changed the name. So they were the same team, essentially, in 1960 and 1998. So that doesn't count.
Okay.
So, let's see. And Japan Series, not Japan Championships. So, the Orion, I'm inclined to go with the franchise that was formerly known as the Mainichi Orion. And then the Tokyo Orions, and then the Lotte Orions, and then the Chiba Lotte Marines.
Well, I'm not sure about the ownership groups in that one, but Dave's answer is the Hawks franchise, which one is Nankai, Daiei, and now SoftBank.
That's right, Lotte, okay, probably true, because Lotte Orions and the Marines are also the same franchise, so, so they won as Mainichi, and they also won as, as Lotte.
Right, and Dave talked about the symmetry with the series wins, and he said the Hawks have two under each ownership group.
Correct.
And two under each of the managers who have won. So Akiyama, the latest, and he won two. Two, and then Katsuto Tsuruoka, he said, with the Daiei franchise, won two. So kind of interesting.
Yes, I think that the Hawks are always my first choice in that respect, and so they won this year. So, okay. Although I'm still, the Orioles still trouble me as a potential answer to that question. Okay, but the other one, of course, the Fighters too, because the Fighters certainly won. One as the Toei Flyers, and they won once as the Nippon Ham Fighters. So and Toei changed the ownership a lot.
Changed its ownership?
Well, the team rearranged its ownership.
A reshuffling kind of a thing, but didn't actually change hands or anything?
Well,
like
they
that?
Did. They did, in fact, because what they did was they changed the way the team was, the ownership structure of the team several times in the 50s, but I don't think they ever won a pennant then, so that would sort of make that a moot point.
Mm.
Okay, anyway, so moving along into the future and into this week.
All right.
So thank you for that, Dave.
Yeah, thanks a lot, Dave. Appreciate it, buddy.
Yeah.
Actually, it was earlier this week then that I talked to Andrew Marchand, and I asked him, I said, how do you pronounce that last name? And I should have known how to pronounce it because there's a guy named Brad Marchand who plays for the Boston Bruins hockey. But I have been seeing Andrew's name and I follow him on Twitter, and I thought it was Marchand. So he says it's Marchand. But then in the interview, I called him Andrew because I was so focused on saying Andrew and saying Marchand that I said Andrew, so that's not actually correct. And Andrew Jones, apologies to you.
Yeah, England, AM, those A&Ws.
Right. So Andrew is an ESPN writer, and he covers the Yankees, and he's been with ESPN for 7 years, and primarily he writes about the Yankees. Yeah, seven, almost eight, I think he said. And he's quite prolific on Twitter, and it's no big surprise he's prolific on Twitter because of the team he covers. He has to be. There's so much going on there.
Mm-hmm.
And there's not much more. There's so much more than the three Japanese players who I mentioned in the interview, and that was, and we'll get to this news later, but Hiroki Kuroda and Ichiro Suzuki and Masahiro Tanaka, but you know, he's had two starting pitchers he needs to go through an interpreter to interview, and that's, you know, that's more than twice a week he's got to deal with that, so I'm sure it was a big issue for him, and wanted to know how he goes about getting in touch with these guys and talking to them, so we talked about that, and I'm not sure what time he normally wakes up, but he got up and got to the Skype for 9 a.m. on the East Coast in the States.
Back when Skype was working for you.
And Skype was working at that time for me, so he had to be lucid and...
he was lucid. Know,
and he had to be very clear-headed at an early hour of the day, so we really appreciate that. And it's all for the love of the game, right?
Yep, absolutely.
All right, so let's listen to what he had to say.
It's our pleasure to welcome Andrew Marchand to the program. He's a senior writer for ESPNNewYork.com, and he covers the New York Yankees. Basically, he covers Ma-kun and Ichiro and Hiroki Kuroda. So thank you very much for joining us on the show this week.
Thanks for having me.
And I understand you're one of the busiest men in the business, so we really appreciate you taking time to chat with us here.
Hey, thanks. No problem.
All right, so from A-Rod to Derek Jeter, I guess there's probably not been that very many dull moments for you while you've been covering the Yankees, but let's get right into it. We want to discuss Masahiro Tanaka. So how did you go about getting information on Ma-kun when his name came up in the posting conversations?
You know, the interesting thing now is that there's so much stuff on the web where you can find things in English and you can read about guys. And a guy like Tanaka, who... is so renowned, and there's so much anticipation, especially in New York with the Yankees possibly getting him. You know, it was easy to find information about him, and also talking to people in baseball who had seen him or heard about him or knew about him, especially from other teams. The Yankees weren't as they didn't want to tell you too much because they really wanted him, obviously.
Obviously, yeah.
So it was easy to kind of. you know, he's sort of a mystery over here a little bit because there wasn't that much video, but and there was also, you know, how good was he? You know, how could he do it in America? He did pretty well.
Yeah, obviously he did very well until he got injured. Now, how do you go about covering with the language issue? Because I remember talking to a friend of mine, Ken Daly. He used to work for the Dallas Morning News, and he also worked in Los Angeles when Hideo Nomo went over to the Dodgers. And he always used to tell me, because I had been in Japan that whole time, and he said, hey, you know, we can't talk to the guy, and the translator doesn't seem to be translating everything. So how do you go about covering a guy like that when there's a language issue?
Well, there's two things that happen. Number one, there's a translator. I think he does a pretty good job. You know, I wouldn't know any better, so.
I was going to say, that's as far as you know.
Exactly. But also, you become friendly a little bit with the Japanese reporters. They speak to Tanaka in Japanese, and sometimes you might say, well, yeah, this is what we were told he said. And then you might say to them, well, what did he say to you? And there have been times, I know, where you kind of say, oh, okay, yeah, it's a little bit clearer now. And so it's kind of a two-way street, because sometimes the Japanese reporters who, you know, almost all speak excellent English. It's very impressive. But they might need some help sometimes in understanding some of either the cultural things or what someone said. You know, sometimes the players or managers talk really quickly.
Right.
So it's kind of a two-way street.
And, you know, I know that you cover more than just Makun, because you've got Ichiro there and you've got Hiroki Kuroda. And I know that sometimes the Japanese media have their own native language time that cuts down on all the availability of these guys. How does that work?
They do. But, you know, it's interesting. Ichiro, who's not getting back with the Yankees this year, but...
Probably not, yeah.
You know, excuse me?
I said probably not, right?
No, I don't think so. But his reputation in Seattle was, you know, he's a little bit aloof. But with us in New York, he was tremendous, very available.
In what way? I mean, he spoke back in English, or did he still went through his interpreter?
He spoke in Japanese. He understood in English, and then he'd speak in Japanese.
Gotcha.
And he's just comfortable expressing himself speaking Japanese, but he understood in English. And then Kuroda, you know, again, Kuroda, what a professional, just a pro, but... In terms of, you know, as an interview subject, there's not as much flair to him as maybe Ichiro. So, you know, we would talk, but basically, you know, just sort of like, how did you pitch that day? And then the off the field stuff with Kuroda, you know, he was a little bit, you know, he's a little less flair. You know, when he would show up in the clubhouse, you know, Ichiro would show up with his, you know, his stylings that he had in terms of his normal clothes. And, you know, you knew Ichiro was around. So he sort of had that rock star kind of thing going for
Well, he's had that for a long time. All right, so now Tanaka apologized when he was sidelined by those elbow issues late in the year. But that's something that's very typical in Japan, so why was it such a big deal in the States?
Well, I think because most people knew that it wasn't his fault that he got hurt. Now, I think he wasn't saying it was his fault. He was just saying, you know, he feels bad he can't be there for the team. You know, that was my understanding of how he meant it.
Right.
So, you know, I think guys might say, I feel bad that I got hurt and I can't help the team out. But in terms of going full out and saying, I'm sorry for letting the team down, you don't generally hear that from players. And so that was, it was different. And so, there's nothing wrong with it. It was good in a lot of respects. It just shows how much he cares. But it was different than what an American athlete generally says when he gets hurt. Even if they show remorse, they don't necessarily apologize. I think it was the word, I'm sorry, you know, using those words, or I apologize. I forgot the exact term he used. But I'm sorry, or I apologize. I think that was what was the stark difference that sort of got everyone's attention. It's like, okay, that's interesting.
Huh, because I've heard some U.S.-based players, you know, in various sports, football, basketball, and baseball, kind of say something or make similar statements about not being available for the team and not being able to perform for the fans. So that just kind of threw me off there. I didn't know what the big deal was.
Yeah, I think they've said similar things, but I don't know if it was as it was a statement, so it was really thought out in terms of how, you know, it wasn't just said to the media, it was released through a statement. You know, I don't know. I think that, quite honestly, when you put Tanaka I apologize. I think, you know, on the web it's going to get a lot of clicks. In the local newspaper it's going to get a lot of attention. And so I just think that's probably why it got so much attention, is because it was just sort of something flashy, because just saying that, even though it wasn't his fault. So, and at that point, Tanaka was such a sensation. Anything he said was going to be a big deal.
Yeah, I think so. I think that was more what it was. I mean, I remember the introductory press conference, and, you know, we actually got a hold of a tape of the press conference, and we played as much as we could of it. And it was just interesting the way that people received him, you know, coming over. He had the rock star thing going from the start. So I think you're right. Anything he was going to say or anything he did was probably just going to be blown out of proportion.
Yeah, no doubt about it.
New York style.
Yeah.
All right. Yeah. So how surprised were you and other media members when Tanaka got off to a winning start? Because he had won so many games in Japan, and then he came over there and picked up that winning streak and kept winning a bunch of games. Well, he was winning. He wasn't pitching all that fantastic, but he was winning games, so especially coming off that run that he had here with the Rakuten Eagles. What was the surprise, or how'd you guys feel about it as members of the media?
Well, we knew he was good. The question was, how good? And he answered it in overwhelming fashion with his start. And so, you know, I think that I didn't really know what to expect exactly, because, you know, you can hear about a guy, you can watch him in spring training, but until he's on that mound in a real game, you don't really know. I mean, again, you get a sense, you talk to guys, you watch his splitter, you see that it's, you know, oh yeah, the talent's there, but it's different spring training compared to the regular season. So it was fascinating every time he started a game. I mean, that was really the major takeaway to me, is that when Tanaka started a game, you wanted to be there, and to see how he did. And that was the excitement. We've seen that in the past with a guy like Dwight Gooden in New York, in LA, Fernando Valenzuela.
Well,
type of excitement.
Particularly, but, you've seen it in New York with another Japanese pitcher named Hideki Irabu.
Definitely, so, with Irabu.
Yeah.
But he didn't have the success, I don't think, at the, you know, start.
Definitely not, but I mean, he had the hype.
Yes, he had the hype, exactly.
And the contract. So, he had a good contract
and the hype and the pressure.
Yeah.
So you never know. Like, Robbie was an example of a guy who came with all that hype and wasn't able to live up to that on the field, on the mound. And it's difficult. It's a difficult situation. And Tanaka, though, was able to handle everything. The other thing that's really impressive about Tanaka is how mature he is.
Mm-hmm.
He really kind of – I wrote this in spring training. He reminded me of Derek Jeter in terms of how he handled things.
Right.
And very, you know, close to the vest and no nonsense. He wasn't really interested in making helping out the media necessarily, but he was interested in just doing his job and letting that do the speaking for him.
Right. And obviously we've seen him pitch since he was a young man in high school, so we'd seen that a lot. And that was no shock to us watching, obviously, from here. And, you know, it was my plan last year to go and see him pitch later in the season, but he got injured before I could get over there to watch him. So I'm going to try to do it this year or this upcoming year. Now, there's a lot of factors that'll impact his final numbers, such as, you know, the bullpen and closing. I know the Yankees obviously lost their closer from last year, but they've gained a new shortstop. Chase Headley just signed. We don't know what A-Rod's going to be doing, probably DHing. But how do you see all that playing out, and if Tanaka's elbow is sound?
How good will the Yankees be?
How will the Yankees behind him, the defense behind him, impact his number?
It should be better. Yeah, I mean, it should help all the pitchers because, you know, Sir D.D. Gregorius – is the new shortstop.
Right, from Arizona.
They replaced the captain with royalty. He is actually, and he's knighted.
Right.
Sir Didi.
Sir Didi.
And so, yeah, him at short. Get Chase Headley back for a full season. He's a pretty good defender. At second, you have Martin Prado. That's his position.
Great, even though he's
not as good as he once was, is still a pretty good first baseman. So your infield defense is much better. That should help all the pitchers. That's one of those things that, even when you're watching every game, it's hard to quantify how much of a difference that makes, but it definitely does
definitely,
for pitchers.
Exactly.
So, that should, you know, those guys should be better, because there's going to be balls that went through last year that don't go through this year, which will save, you know, quarter points or half a point on your ERA, which at the end of the year, you look at the numbers, that makes a big difference.
Right, and you still need guys to close it down in the bullpen, too, after he's gone. Obviously, them losing the closer is going to impact the team, but what do you see happening with the bullpen there?
Well, they have Dellin Betances, who last year was...
He was a monster.
Yeah, exactly. 6'9".
Yeah.
I mean, throwing 99, 100 miles per hour.
Yeah.
And so he's a guy who really could move into that closer spot. And then they signed Andrew Miller, who is the left-hander,
right.
Who was awesome last year, just as good as Betances. So, and they lost David Robertson. So basically, it's a wash. I mean, the thing about Miller is that he was so good last year, but that was really—he's only had a year and a half of really good pitching in his career. So, you know, it's still a wait and see situation if he's going to be a dominant pitcher on here on out. But that should help him. I mean, if those guys pitch well, I mean, that could be a dominant part of this Yankee team, the bullpen.
I think it can be. Well, we'll have to see. I'm just worried about bridging the gap to the ninth inning, but have high expectations for him. We don't want to see Makun's wins, you know, turn into Yankee losses.
Yeah, that wouldn't be good for the Yankees or for him.
No, it wouldn't be. All right. So Yu Darvish mentioned this at one point during the past season, and we've talked about it here on our show extensively. In fact, before Darvish actually mentioned it, but with the Tommy John outbreak, is what I'm calling it, because there's so much going on about it, being written about how many surgeries are being performed and how sometimes some players are being urged to get the procedure done when they actually don't need it, and how some people think it makes the elbow stronger and all that other stuff. But how seriously would MLB teams consider the notion of pitching their starters once a week?
I think they'll consider it.
You think so?
I think they'll consider it.
No. I mean, I, you know, to be honest, I didn't think it would be something they'd consider, because I think it impacts contracts so much.
Well, that's the thing. I mean, on both sides, I don't know if pitchers would want to be paid less potentially. And they are investing a lot of money, so they want to get as much bang for their buck. However, if it's proven, if they could somehow feel as if that they would get, healthier pitching staff, instead of having every guy needing elbow surgery, you had a situation where, you know, guys pitch 25 starts a year instead of 32, but you had them for 25, they might consider doing that. I mean, I don't think it's out of the realm of possibilities. Things have evolved over time. I mean, there was a time where pitching staffs were 4-man rotations. Now they're 5-man rotations.
Right.
The bullpen wasn't as big a deal, you know, back in the day. You know, if you're a reliever, it kind of meant you stunk. Now it might mean, well, they'd rather have starters, but it might mean you just have dominant stuff for an inning or two, and we'd rather use you there than a guy who struggles to go 5 innings because of his limited repertoire. So, I'm not saying it's going to happen. I'm saying it could evolve, though, into that.
Oh, I hear you. I don't really think it's going to happen, but I didn't really think it would be on the table for consideration. So, to hear you say that, Maybe if Darvish makes a bigger push, he can get it. The Rangers to start thinking about it. I think the Colorado Rockies are going to think about it because the way they use their tandem pitching anyway.
Yeah, it's a good point. That's a good point.
All right, so last question for you, and I didn't put this one on the list, but I wanted to ask you this because during the past season, you tweeted that the Yankees were doing a good job of developing Tanaka. And I know Twitter doesn't really provide a lot of space for you to expound on exactly what you mean, but we've seen him, like I said, we've seen him pitch for a long time. We know how good and how poised and how calm and how much a quality pitcher he has been for quite a number of years. So what exactly did you mean by that statement when you made it? I think it was about halfway through his starts. I think it was about.
Okay, yeah, hopefully it was before he got hurt.
Yeah, well, definitely before he got hurt.
I think what I was referring to is that the way they made his schedule, whenever there was an off day, you know, when they could make an off day, they used it so Tanaka could have more rest.
Mm-hmm.
Because he was coming from Japan, where you had the longer layoffs between starts, to try to make his transition easier and to keep him healthy. Obviously, it didn't fully work. However,
yeah,
they did everything they could to try to do that. You know, if you did it the opposite way and just pitched him like every other starter, he probably would have gotten hurt as well. So I think in terms of taking special care for Tanaka because he's so valuable, such an asset, I thought they were doing a good job.
Okay.
What do I know?
Yeah, I mean, it's hard. We obviously assumed that they would be taking him out of games a little bit earlier. I know a scout who has been watching Tanaka for a long time, and that was one of the concerns. And he said, hey, look, this is no little diminutive pitcher. This is a big, strong guy, and we're not really worried about him going over and taking on the workload. And, of course, he didn't come out of games here in Japan. He'd get into trouble in the sixth inning and the seventh inning, and they'd send the pitching coach out there to the mound just to tell him to, you know, slow down a little bit. You got a long way to go.
Yeah.
So, he's developed, basically on his own, and he was a stud in high school. He was a stud over here in Japan, and I think he's going to be, if he's healthy, he's going to be just as good as he was before he got injured last year, I think, coming up this season.
There's a good chance of that, no doubt. I mean, if he's healthy, he could be just as good. I'll tell you what, the Yankees need him to be that good if they're going to have a quality season.
All right. Well, we'll be keeping an eye on him, and we really appreciate your time. And I know you're busy, so thank you very much for taking the time out to chat with us. We really enjoyed it.
Thanks, John. Best to you.
Thank you, Andrew.
Andrew, not Andrew.
Wow, so you got me doing it now, man. Fuck that.
It's quite contagious, this affliction I have here.
Indeed it is.
So that was pretty straightforward. Anything stick out for you?
Well, I really liked it. I mean, I did spend a lot of time this year, obviously, following what the Yankees were doing, you know, writing all the stories for Kyoto News. But, yeah, it was interesting, and I thought, the bit about the defense, I think, he tried to say, but was prohibited by the New York Baseball Writers Union from saying that Yankees defense is going to be a lot better because Derek Jeter's going to be gone.
El Capitan is off the field, so
yeah,
now they can catch these balls.
It's like you can almost hear that. Actually, you can almost hear that on the Yes Network. Some guy's about to say it, but then they realize they're not allowed to.
They'll be booted out of the New York Writers Union.
They will,
huh?
Indeed, because that comes, pretty much if you're in New York and you're dealing with the Yankees, you have to sign a contract that says you will never question Derek Jeter's defense.
Well, I remember about 7 years ago that you and I were sitting around in the office and we were talking about Derek Jeter's defense, and I said, well, he's still a pretty good defensive player, and you said, no, he's not. And I guess we engaged in a little bit of debate, but that was at the first time, and this is 7-8 years ago, that I realized that he wasn't very strong defensively anymore, not like he was when he was in his 20s.
I'll tell you, he does things, he does a couple of things really well. One is that he's really smart. He makes good judgments, which is a huge part of that job. And the other thing is he's got a great arm.
Right.
So it seems from what I've watched is he's great at cheating to his right, into the hole, so mm-hmm. he can make that play and show off his arm.
Mm-hmm.
And he gives up basically everything between his, almost a huge area between himself and second base.
Yeah.
And that's what I've noticed about him, because all the metrics that basically have ever been done show that he's not a very good shortstop.
Yeah, and I just know that he was very athletic. You know,
yeah.
he was very good.
Great.
And he pretty much had some really really good hands. But
yes.
But that he didn't have a lot of range.
Right, and he knows, he looks like he has a lot of range because he goes to his right very well, because he's always cheating to his right, and he makes those throws, and he's got a great arm. So, people will often judge shortstops by how well they throw from the hole. And that's what he does. And he also goes back on pop flies fairly well, which is an important thing, which he goes back on them pretty well. So, he does the things that, but, it's the whole body of work is a huge question mark that you're not allowed to question in New York. So he didn't say it, but Didi Gregorius is going to be a big improvement. I know people thought Edwin Nunez was a big improvement. although Edwin Nunez was not a hitter, and he also made errors, and Derek Jeter doesn't make a lot of errors.
Right. So, yeah.
So anyway, so he almost was about to say that, but obviously it was more important to stay in the New York Writers Union. Although now that Derek Jeter has come out and crucified the New York writers, as soon as he got off the field, and the first thing he says is, I'm going to start writing because I wouldn't waste my time talking to the writers who'd been deifying me for the last 15 years.
yeah, no reason to...
I didn't trust them one bit. Which is probably, you know, probably a good thing, because as soon as, you know, they start making a god out of you, you know that if they think they can make a god out of you, they can turn you into Hideki Urabu in the next breath.
Yeah, well, I mean, they can glorify and they can certainly excommunicate with the stroke of a key. We know
sure,
that.
And I absolutely understand that. I mean, it's as maddening as it is as a sports writer to have athletes who won't tell you the simplest things. You know, won't throw you a single bone.
Right. Yep. Yeah.
You know. So anyway, but that was an interesting thing for me. I think the Masahiro Tanaka course is the main course in that feast.
Definitely. Definitely.
And you know, I think what you said is, you know, yeah, I think that he was trying to dance around that the Yankees developed, but that's, you know, that's. You get that being in America. You think, you know, that's like Columbus discovered America. Well, what about the people who are living there already?
Like, well, don't mind them. They didn't know where they were.
That's right. They had to wait until some Italian dude showed up to tell them they were in India.
So, yeah. Well, I mean, that, you know, that was one of the things I did want to ask him, and I saved it for last. But you know, I saw that tweet earlier in the season, and I'm like, I think I responded to him. And obviously, when he works in that kind of a market, he doesn't really reply to tweets and responses to his tweets. But yeah, I thought, and I wanted to give him an opportunity to explain it. And I think he did. You say danced around. I think. He kind of realized that wasn't the case probably at the time, but you know, Twitter doesn't give you a lot of space to expound on things, and he really didn't have an opportunity to say, yeah, they've done well with integrating him into the U.S. style of baseball and style of pitching, and they haven't rushed him in. They've taken it slowly. And,
well, I think Joe Girardi has the absolute right approach to his Japanese pitchers. And, you know, I talked about that with Kuroda in September and, you know, the usage. And he said, well, I asked him if, because he was much more solid in the second half this year than last year. And he said that was not so much a matter of the usage, but the fact that in 2013, in the first half of the season, it's like every game he was pitching was nothing through five innings.
Right.
You know, everyone was a one-run game, and he's such a bulldog that it just ate him up. And yeah. Then he didn't have anything left for the second half. It wasn't so much the days off between starts as much as the nature of the games he was playing.
Right.
So, yeah, that was kind of interesting. The whole bit about, you know, we knew Tanaka, but I also thought the comparison with Derek Jeter was so on. I mean, that never occurred to me, but it is. Because Tanaka is the same guy. He won't give you nothing unless he thinks, you know, unless he feels like it.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, you go to dinner at Makun's place and he ain't serving.
he just points you in the direction and say, get your own.
Here's nothing. Yeah. What are you here for?
Well, you know, the thing that I thought was not dead on about it was that Jeter was a young kid when he came in, and obviously Makun has a lot of experience on the pro level. That's the part that was not. But I guess certainly Makun came in under a microscope, whereas Jeter kind of he didn't come in under that microscope. But
yeah,
still, they were both very poised. Yeah, I'm sure.
He took over the city, but again, that's the thinking in. U.S. in New York, that every player, the first time they wear a Yankees uniform, the Yankees discovered them. Well, like, you've never been to New York before. Well, welcome to life. You know, okay. It's like, you know, Wilfred, you know, how how do you feel now that you're no longer a zombie?
Gosh. Well, you know, look, here's another thing, is that the Yankees have been watching Monkun for a long time. And it's interesting that, you know, if you and I were to go over and cover and to go to the pressers, we would be able to survive without the interpreter. And we would be able to say, okay, well, he said this in Japanese and he said this in English, and we know that there's a difference, there's a gap. But just like Andrew said, you know, he wouldn't know the difference if his interpreter didn't do a great job or not, but we would know. And, you know, it's just like the story I said when Nomo went over in 95, and I would call. You know, I was doing columns from Nagoya, as you probably even might recall. And my buddy said, you know, he had to invent ways to cover Nomo. And I just found it interesting that these reporters, that Andrew would say, hey, look, we'd go to the Japanese reporters, and while their English is pretty good and it's amazing that they've, you know, come this far, that they didn't understand every little thing or every little detail that Joe was saying, or Joe Girardi, the manager, was saying, or some of the pitching coaches or something, and then they could get extra information from the Japanese media. And the other thing is, you know, that availability for the Japanese media, and we see it all the time, because we'll see the stories that come over on a Yankee game in Japanese, and the stories that are written in the AP and the mainstream media over there. And there's definitely a gap. You know, there's a huge gap sometimes. And I found that interesting that they would go, you know, just like over here. And it's good to see the U.S. and Japan media members, like, mixing it up like that and exchanging information to get the stories right. Sure. You know, there's a definite gap between some of the really good, juicy quotes that these guys give and some of the ones that are given in the main pool media with the U.S. press.
I mean, we see that in Japan as well with foreign players. Well, with the foreign players who speak with us in English. You know, we get the raw English, and we also hear what's being translated into Japanese, and, you know, there's sometimes some eye rolling.
Sometimes.
I remember the great story. Now, of course, in Japan, you know, every player who drives in a run will have the PR guy talk to them when they get a chance and have them give a flash quote for the, that's now, it used to be always on paper in the press box. You know, the PR guy would come around and hand out the quotes.
Right.
Almost without exception, it'll, you know, the standard, they have a pattern. It says, fastball, our pitcher was doing so well, so I knew I had to try to do something to get it done. And I was going to do whatever it took to get in a run.
Right.
You know, I got a good pitch and I hit it. You know, some variation along that. But almost always, I was going to do whatever I could. It always sounds like the other guys weren't. It was me. But anyway, one time in the Pacific League playoffs, before they were called the Climax Series in 2005, Matt Franco of the reporters asked Matt Franco of the Chibolote Marines to expound on his comments in the flash quotes. And he said, I never said that. And then he took the interpreter and kind of cornered him up against the wall and said, don't ever tell people something I didn't say.
Yeah.
I got enough trouble saying the things I do say.
Exactly. Exactly. Yeah. Well, yeah, that stuff is really interesting. And the other thing that was interesting to me was the notion that the U.S. would consider going to a six-man rotation. And I wasn't at all expecting Andrew to say what he said. And I think Darvish is going to make a push for it, but I don't think, and I can't say that he's going to make a push for it, but I think him coming off injury would make, certainly make Texas consider it. And like I said, Colorado, the Rockies have this tandem starter thing going, so who knows? But anyway.
Well, I think this is really an interesting point. Another thing is that you're saying Darvish would make a push, but I think the reason people would listen to Darvish is because it's not just Darvish. And I think you're speaking about Darvish being hurt and they wanted to take it carefully. Think about that. You know, you called it an epidemic. Or people are calling it an epidemic, so it ain't just Darvish. There's a lot of pitchers who are going to need the extra help.
Yeah.
I think that is going to fuel that. But I was also surprised by all the people, by, you know, Mike Maddox and other people with the Major League All-Stars saying, and pitchers saying, you know, we might need that extra day of rest because this is an issue.
Yeah, interesting.
The other thing, which I thought was really interesting this year, was I'd always been, you know, I'd always followed the Bill James and another analyst, Craig Wright, their feeling that really the five-man rotation was a dead end, and that four-man, you know, if properly monitored, could do well. But I think that's because it worked for so long.
Right.
But that Bill James did a very interesting study this year that I was really surprised by, because I'd done similar studies in Japan and I hadn't noticed it. My results have been different about what happens when you're pitching on short, you know, on 4 days rest with a heavy, you know, coming off a heavy workload. And his conclusion, which was different from mine, was that you're not as effective. Mm-hmm. That basically the more you pitch, the less effective you get.
Uh-huh.
I noticed that, actually what I noticed was that a study I did in the mid-90s showed that pitchers coming off of high pitch count games actually tended to pitch quite good the next time. But the following week, their following start, they tended to show signs of they tended to show a letdown. And his point was he set up basically a counting system, you know, trying to establish how much wear and tear and, you know, and how much rest they were getting,
mm-hmm.
factor how much they pitched and how much rest they got between starts. And it didn't erase after one start. It just kept accumulating. And basically there was a correlation between how much the amount of rest pitchers don't get and the amount of work they do that weighs on their future effectiveness. And it was at that point which he said, I think maybe we need to go to a six-man rotation or think of something differently. And in the winter meetings, I had a number of people tell me that, you know, a number of baseball MLB people tell me that having a Monday off,
uh-huh.
or doing something to that effect to make the schedule, you know, reducing the games or to do something to that effect, maybe where baseball is going.
That's fascinating stuff because, again, I just didn't think that they'd be receptive. And I know pitching has changed and evolved. And like Andrew said, that there used to be a four-man rotation. Now it's five.
Yeah.
Hopefully they will evolve because, you know, I read some statistics and I don't want to bore everybody, but they talked to the reason I called it.
That's what I do.
Well, the reason I called this Tommy John procedure thing an epidemic is because the information that I read recently was that they were having, you know, some parents were having their young high school kids just go ahead and have Tommy John surgery, even though they're not injured, just to prevent it. And, you know, as a preventative measure to avoid having to go through it in the future. And
wow.
It's just ridiculous. You know, if we're getting to that point, you know, let's not even play baseball. I mean, that's the best, that's the most preventive way I can see it from happening. Let's play another sport. So, I mean, it's just getting ridiculous. But anyway, that's all interesting stuff. And I want to move along here since we're having technical difficulties and talk about some other stuff. But we want to say thank you again to Andrew for waking up early in the morning and taking the time to talk to us.
Yep, we know what that's like.
All right, let's talk MPV and
sure.
Chihiro Kaneko, the ace of the Oryx Buffaloes. No surprise here, he re-signed with Oryx this past week, just like you said, just like the front office executive said they were going to work hard to get him to come back, and he's back. And he said in a quote that he wanted to win the championship that he wasn't able to get last season with this team. And two things struck me as I was translating an article that we had in our paper this week,
yeah.
That Oryx thinks, you know, it has thrown up enough cash, like I said before, and I think in the last show, adding Hiroyuki Nakajima, Tony Blanco, Brian Bullington, and Eiichi Koyana, and it gives them depth and freedom to use different combinations at the end of games or make more moves in leverage situations. But I think this is the biggest move for that team is to retain its ace, because if you don't have that guy to build your pitching, I mean, imagining him, that pitching, that rotation without him, it's hard to see them competing even with the guys they added.
Well, I don't know about that, because there are guys, Oryx has a lot of guys who are really, they're not a lot of adjustments away from being better, but of course what you have in Conoco is a guy who can make those adjustments on a weekly basis. You know, it's not, you know, a big difference, of course, a big difference between pitchers is, you know, what kind of stuff you have and how it plays, but also how you can adapt what you've got today to today's game. And, you know, I've talked loud and at great length and, you know, caused a lot of sleep, you know, put people back to sleep quite a bit discussing the differences between Yu Darvish and Masahiro Tanaka. But the, essentially, you know, another way to put this is Tanaka's adjustment cycle, you know, between the time that he realizes something is wrong to the time he finds space in the game to fix it. And the time that he actually applies that and moves, gets back, you know, moves on to a new course, very, very short. It's like the shortest I've ever seen of any pitcher I've ever watched. Darvish is pretty normal. You know, he's in a cycle where very often, if he needs to make a major adjustment, you know, it's something that happens between innings or between games.
Right.
We'll often get a quote from Darvish, "Well, I've been working on that. I know this was a problem the last two starts." You never hear Tanaka say, "This is a problem the last two starts."
Right, right.
Yeah, this was a problem the last two pitches.
Or the last two batters or something,
that's,
yeah.
That's, and Conoco, and what you get with the better pitchers is so often not that his stuff is that much better, although that's a factor, but you get the fact that he's used to throwing in lots of situations.
Yeah, they've got really good cycles, and I think Conoco is, yeah, like you said, he can make adjustments, and I'm sure he's going to be able to make those adjustments. And we know he's going to have cartilage cleared out of his elbow and all that stuff, so he's coming off a procedure.
He's already had it done.
Yeah, he's coming off a procedure going into this season, but I still think they need to build their, or they need to plan their rotation around him. I'm not sure.
They can, because the real story was that his contract with Oryx includes no agreement that will require them to post him if he desires to be posted.
Yeah, I didn't think he was the, I just didn't feel like he wanted to go to the States.
I'm all with you on that one. I you know, people asked him, he's like, "Oh, don't bother me with questions." You know? He was getting out. He was Keigawa, and I wouldn't be surprised to find, I know that the company that his agent works for, his actual representative works for a guy named Mihara, and he's the same agent who was Tsuyoshi Nishioka's, and I wouldn't be half surprised if it wasn't the same agent who was Keigawa's.
Yeah, I don't know either, but... you know, instead of focusing on him, though, and now they can focus on what they're going to do with the lineup and who the, you know, they got so many players and they added a lot of depth. And that's the one thing that they did lack, was the depth in being able to make some favorable matchups late in games. And I think they can do that now. Let's say they have Esteban Herman and Koyano. I don't know if they're going to share third, or Koyano's going to be mainly a pinch hitter or whatever. And then they've got Yoichi Adachi, who played really well at short the past two seasons. I think he's almost got 1,100 plate appearances now over the past two seasons. But now I don't know what they do with him. Is he are they going to drop him to the farm so he can stay sharp?
Hirano, is there too.
I think Giordano's going to play, but I think, again, and he's a really good second baseman, but he can also play multiple positions. He can play in the outfield as well. So
yeah, but he's not the number one. You know, he's not going to push a Shunta Goto out of playing in center field. That guy can really play.
Shunta, yeah.
But it's going to make these decisions really, really hard. And, you know, you've got guys like Tomotaka Sakaguchi, who's really, you know, he's like the heart of that team, and he ain't got a place to play anymore.
Yeah.
His career's run out of gas. If he's healthy, he can still play, but his health is an issue.
Right. Well, they just, you know, it's just like I said, they've added a lot of depth, and now instead of bringing up an inexperienced guy for a pinch-hitting spot late in the game or sending up a guy who's inexperienced because somebody else is injured and you just have to bat that guy, now they have more options. They can send up some guys with a track record who can hit, and, you know, it'll be interesting to see how they put it together.
Well, see, I think, that is, for me, the point is, how do you put it together? Because they've added so much new stuff.
Well, that's...
It's not like... I mean, the typical successful pattern is a team adds two or three players, you know, to the mix, and, you know, and they have places for them to play, and they have options. But here, it's basically, you know, Moriwaki's going, wow, look at all the pieces to this jigsaw puzzle. there's like 10,000, the best jigsaw puzzle ever.
Well, start playing around, dude, and then find some pieces and put them someplace, because you...
He's like going to camp, said, we're going to need a bigger table.
Spread these things out here. Well, you know, it's good for him, though. I mean, I it's good that they have a lot of options and a lot of talent, because they usually don't. So that's his job to make it work together, and, you know, if he can't do it, they'll find somebody else who can. So let's move on now. I actually had Ichiro and Aoki and Toritani at the top of this note, but then we woke up this morning to the news that Hiroki Kuroda is scheduled to return to the Hiroshima Carp at the age of 39, and I guess he'll be pitching into his 40s. with the team he started with. So what was your initial impression when you saw that news?
Well, I was really surprised, because I know, I think, same as everybody, you know, he's got a bit left in the tank. And I've always figured he'd come back to Hiroshima if there was a gap between his feeling about how much he could pitch was not equaled by major league team offers. You know, that's pretty much the standard. If you think you can still play, but you're not getting a job, then you come back to Japan. But obviously, if this report is true, which it seems like it is,
but
I'm not surprised that the story was broken, the Chugoku Shimbun, which is the hometown paper of the Carp.
Yeah.
You know, had it been somebody else, maybe. But it was a big story. It was the front page news in Hiroshima, and they have to be thinking, "Wow, I think we're real. You know, let's just post ourselves as the Central League favorites this year."
Yeah, I think that adds. We just talked about depth, and I think that adds some significant depth in theory to the Hiroshima Carp. Obviously, we don't know how Kuroda is going to pitch here, but we know that he can pitch here. But it's been 8 years since he has pitched here, and he's going to be 39. He is 39. He's going to be 40. So
right.
We'll have to see. I'm glad for the Carp. I think it's a nice pull for him. I hope Ichiro takes the hint. And I've seen rumors. There was one rumor in a, you know, the newspapers here, the sports papers here in Japan can go nuts. And there was one rumor that Ichiro was going to.
They are nuts.
That I saw him signing a 1-year deal with Oryx to come back home and play out his career. You know, I've seen stuff about Toritani team sniffing around him, but he still hasn't signed, and he's going to have to wait until next year. And then I saw a story about Hanshin not wanting to go make a hasty decision on thinking that it would bring Toritani back. Aoki, I haven't really seen that much about him other than the fact that he hasn't had many suitors. So it's just kind of weird with these free agents here.
Well, I think Aoki, we discussed this before. I think Aoki's market is hurt by the fact that he played for Kansas City,
mm-hmm.
Where offensive numbers are really suppressed. Right. That being the case, he and his negotiating team probably had a very accurate view of his place in the market, and nobody really shares it.
Yeah, I just find it.
Trying to get a bargain right now, and he basically, considering the Royals have gone out and gotten more help in the outfield, I don't think he's got a place to play in Kansas City anymore.
Yeah, I don't think so.
He's priced himself out of Kansas City.
Yeah.
And people are going, they're just waiting for the I think what happens now is teams are waiting for the price to drop on him.
Do you think Toyotani gets a job in the States? I'm starting to think that, they're not interested.
Well, I think it's possible, but here again, we've got the Kang is going over from Korea. And basically, this market was a good one for middle infielders 3 weeks ago. When Scott Boras said that was the case in San Diego, I was right in line with that. But we've seen so many shorts. Every trade conversation has been about whether middle infielders are involved in trades,
mm-hmm.
Who's around. I don't think the market has changed a little bit. Scott Boras said he wanted this deal done by the end of the year. But I don't hear it happening. Obviously, it ain't going to happen now. Now that they're on, teams also know that Toritani's on a clock. That probably in the next 10 or 12 days, he's going to have to decide to come back to Hanshin. And so the price for him is going to get lower. He's not going to get more valuable.
His biological clock is ticking.
Well, Hanshin Tigers' clock is ticking because essentially they've told all the teams that we want a deal done quickly.
Yeah.
Which they'll take a discount to get a deal done quickly, which is the antithesis of Scott Boras' way of doing things, which is to wait until the teams had to pay your price.
Right.
It's almost like a parody of Scott Boras negotiating. And where he's put himself in a poor position to favor his client, which is antithetical to Scott Boras. Normally, it's all about what Scott Boras thinks is best for his client. He wanted Daisuke Matsuzaka to go back to Japan instead of take that deal from the Red Sox.
Yeah. Well, I think what's really messing Toritani up is his age. I mean, that's why I said the biological clock. I think had he made this decision 2 or 3 years ago, he would have gone over.
He had the decision to make 3 years ago.
Yeah. And
he turned it down. He signed a multi-year deal with Hanshin then.
Yeah. So if this was a ploy to get more money or to get a good deal in Japan or a better deal or up the ante or something, then I think he failed miserably. And
I doubt that would be him.
Yeah. I don't get it. I don't understand. And I don't see a market for a guy like that. I said that at the beginning. So we'll see where he ends up. I can't say that I hope he ends up coming back to Hanshin because I think
that's... Yeah, it looks like get that spot in the Ginoza in Okinawa ready, keep that room open for him.
Yeah, yeah. All right, and then Kensuke Tanaka, another second baseman or another middle infielder, he's back with the Fighters, and he came back. Now, he struggled with the glove in the States, and that was a shocker in one sense to me because in another sense it wasn't a shock because... I don't know the context of his problems, whether they are throwing or fielding. But
it was throwing. He caught, the dreaded, he had the wrong genes and he had Steve Sachs syndrome.
Okay, because remember he played so many games on that Sapporo Dome artificial turf that there's a lot of smooth surfaces. Even around the PL, there's Sapporo Dome, Seibu Dome, Fukuoka, Kyocera, a lot of smooth surfaces. And then he goes over there where, he wasn't sure about the bounces. So maybe that did affect his throwing because, you're out there in the grass and the dirt, and this is a real infield as opposed to that man-made one.
He made 15 errors in 2013.
15 in 2013. What about this year?
Six. He went from 28 double plays. He went from 28 double plays and 15 errors in 2013. And this year he was in Round Rock, Texas, and he went for 34 double plays and 6 errors, which is still not great, but it's in the normal range.
All right, so he had 15 in 2013, and he went to 6. So yeah, you're right. Okay, he had a normal season this year.
He had a .937 fielding percentage as a short second baseman in Fresno. So that was a shock for everybody that he suddenly didn't know how to play second base, and why the Giants used him as a left fielder pinch hitter.
Right. So I mean, going back to the Fighters now, I mean, what do they do at second base then?
Okay, that's a good question, because Nakashima can pick. He's not, but the problem is, so can Tanaka, and Tanaka can get on base like crazy. Nakashima's pretty borderline. He's a guy who doesn't really have the big upside that Tanaka has right now. And I would also bet you that having faced different kinds of pitchers, Tanaka's probably a better hitter coming back to Japan than he was when he left. So, I think Nakashima just has to, find a seat on the bench somewhere.
Do you throw a guy like that on the bench, or do you put him in the minor leagues and say, hey, look, we'd rather have you playing every day so that you keep...
You wouldn't in Japan, because almost nobody does that. You send a guy to the minor leagues, he doesn't have time to play because the games are so sporadic. You got time to practice more.
More practice time. All right. Well, I think with...
You know, what you do in America is you trade them. you try to get another prospect at a different position, but you don't do that in Japan.
So I think there'll be an adjustment period, obviously, for Hideki Kuriyama and a lot of the players when the Fighters open camp and everything. But I think it's a good move for them. I think it'll provide an offensive spark for them.
Well, the thing is, I think it will. I think that, he gives them that, he's going to give them a lot of more base runners. And that's really what they need. The Fighters' defense, when he left and when Inaba was unable to play right field, was unable to play the outfield, and Itoi was traded. With Itoi and Tanaka on, left a huge hole in the Fighters' defense that they're just kind of digging out of now. And now he comes back, and it's like, now what are we going to do? So the defense is sort of like set, but Obiki's gone as well. So Obiki had a better year last year, his second year at Sapporo Dome.
Mm-hmm.
But I don't think he was ever going to be a big player.
No,
I don't think it would be a loss. I think putting it to Tanaka, seeing if Nakashima can play short or instead of Yama. Yama's got no bat.
What do you think about this? Because I thought it was odd that they were letting Obiki go after he had probably one of his better seasons.
Oh, yeah, his career year, basically.
Do you think this Kensuke Tanaka thing was in the works, right after the season ended? I kind of thought it was once I saw that they had picked him up. I thought, okay, well, that makes sense now, because Obiki coming off such a good year for him and them being able to bring back Kensuke Tanaka, there was no opening for Obiki.
No, I think what it is the Fighters are a little bit like the Oakland A's.
Uh-huh.
And they're dealing with free agents and their own players. They have spite. They get spiteful of, like some of the stuff we heard out of Oakland this autumn. But they tend to put a value on a player, and then they just sort of don't get emotional about it.
Right.
Yeah. Players' value, the player's asking price exceeds the value. They just look for the next player.
All right. So the Fukuoka SoftBank Hawks are going to move in the fences. They're going to try to get more home runs, I suppose.
Yeah.
And I wonder if they actually figure out how many home runs this should add for them and for their opponents. But
yeah, they never seem to think about that. I think of course, what would have happened 10 years ago is they just would have. Ask Mizuno to give them livelier balls.
Right. Give us different balls.
Because that's what they say. We used to have teams that hit. We had 203 home runs with Matsunaka and Iguchi and Jojima and Kokubo one year. and they all hit 30 home runs. And this, yeah, but that's the problem, was that the ball was massively different.
Yeah, yeah. So, and then next year on March 21st at Tokyo Dome, Derek Jeter and Hideki Matsui are going to have a charity event. And mm-hmm. this should be a fun day. They're going to have a home run hitting contest, which should be kind of interesting because Jeets is fresh out of retirement, whereas Machan has been sitting around getting fat, so to speak. And
well, Matsui said he's going to, you know, he mentioned that in the press conference that, you know, he'll be conceding a little bit of a, you know, he'll have a little bit of rust to shake off for that. So perhaps, yeah. you know, he'll build up for that by, you know, taking some extra BP at the Yankee spring training.
Yeah, yeah, at the Yankee spring. And I wrote a blog post the other day. I don't really think Matsui, I'm adamant about the fact that I don't think he's cut from the managerial cloth, in my opinion, but his toe dipping as a part-time temporary coach with the Yankees and the Giants, and this will be back-to-back spring trainings that he's done, and I think it's kind of silly. I'd like to see him, like, pick one team and do something and see if he likes it or not, or if he can do it or not. But well, you know, obviously you said, I remember you saying numerous times that he wants to live in New York. He prefers living over there. So I won't expect him to be yanked back by the Yomiuri Giants' strong magnetic pull. But I do, obviously
that,
they...
That was. I always wondered what the Giants had going for them. Physics.
Yeah, it's physics. It's physics. All right, and the physics of the cyber world have conspired against us, so we're going to say goodbye here. Thanks for a great year. Thank you, Jim, for always being there with a great comments and great insight for us all the time. Thank you very much. That's it for the year. Thank you very much, and we will talk to you next year. Enjoy your off-season.